Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the showdown on the streets of Egypt between the Islamist supporters of President Morsi and opposition protesters, many of whom fought to topple the military dictator 2 years ago, only to be shut out of the revolution they brought about. Sheila Carapico, who was recently a visiting professor in political science at American University in Cairo, joins us to discuss Egypt's polarization and paralysis that might lead to the military stepping back into power. Then we'll examine the reasons behind the doubling of interest rates from 3.4 to 6.8% on federal student loans set to go into effect on Monday following the failure of the Congress to agree. House Republicans insist on tying the rates to U.S. Treasuries with a cap of 8.5%, while Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal to set rates at 0.75%, which is what big banks pay for money from the Federal Reserve, didn't even make it to the Senate floor. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republican Report and the founding director of Campus Progress, joins us to discuss a dysfunctional government making money off the backs of indentured students. Then finally, we will get an analysis of the much-heralded Senate immigration bill passed Thursday, with congratulations heaped upon the so-called Gang of Eight, whose exercise in bipartisanship drove an $8 billion bill up to $40 billion for additional border security that one of the bill's sponsors, Senator Corker, called overkill. Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, joins us to examine a punitive and pork-laden House bill that House Republicans deem dead on arrival. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. She's the author of Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. And her forthcoming book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Nice to speak with you again.
And what's the sense of this standoff in Egypt? And it's all over the country in all the major cities, massive protests for and against President Morsi. He is sort of urging his people to come out and support him. At the same time, he's telling the protesters that they should listen to the voices of wisdom. Is that likely to work?
No, I'd say it's probably unlikely to work, particularly since he doesn't seem to manage to speak in a voice of wisdom himself. I mean, he gave this long-winded speech earlier this week, which, you know, many people were criticizing everything from his grammar to his word choice to his, you know, kind of scolding tone. And, you know, in addition, I mean, a number of the decisions he's made have not seemed to be wisely thought through. And then, of course, you know, there's, I mean, problems particularly with electricity and water and traffic and fuel and, you know, other essential services. So when he tries to represent the voice of authority and then also of wisdom, I think a lot of people are responding kind of with derision and sneers and laughter and kind of typical Egyptian jokes. But at the same time, I mean, there's a real standoff, and people are extremely tense and worried about how the excuse me, the next few days will play out.
So is he – he is he's probably one of the most conservative of the – I think the three Islamist candidates that represented the Muslim Brotherhood. And my sense is that he's quite autocratic, and he is really quite fundamentalist. Is that his problem? Is that he the arrogance and the sense of authority that he has over as if the Egyptian people that don't agree with him are errant children? Is that a product of his religiosity?
You know, I'm not convinced that it is really a product of his religiosity. I mean, I think a lot of Egyptians, to a lot of Egyptians, it seems that Morsi imagined that he would be elected to be the new dictator. So there would be an election, and a new leader would be chosen, but would then basically take up Mubarak's power. And so he has, of course, alienated, you know, everyone except for his dwindling base, and doesn't seem to have any sense that, I mean, he and his supporters say, well, we've been elected, and so now we make the decisions, and the rest of you just shut up. And that's, I think, not exclusively Islamist or ideological in the sense that certainly Mubarak was secular and very different, but had the same, you know, attitude, I'm in charge, I don't need, you know, any input from the public. So I think it goes beyond his ideological background to kind of deep-seated problems in the Egyptian body politic. But if you go back to 2.5 years ago when the, you know, the slogan was Ishab Yurid Iskat An-Nizam, which we all translated correctly as the people want the downfall of the regime, but that last word, Nizam, also means the system. And he's very much taken back the system of absolute presidential power. And, of course, that's exacerbated by the fact that there's no functioning parliament. So it's really a problem of someone who imagines himself to have been elected dictator.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapikos, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, and she was recently a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. Now, it's at this point, the police, of course, are pretty much pro-Mubarak, and they're kind of furious about this government of Morsi, and they're certainly not going to try and crack heads on his behalf. That's my understanding. And then you've got the military, who are being quite coy, calling for restraint, but at the same time not doing anything. And so it sort of feels like a bit of a free for all. You've got Morsi's people out there, and if he gets a little bit too paranoid and or too autocratic and starts unleashing them on the protesters, it could get really nasty, couldn't it?
Well, indeed it could, and indeed it may. I mean, the police, as you say, they're not willing to fight either for Morsi or, you know, on behalf of the protesters who seem to them, perhaps rightly, to have been the people who kind of stripped them of their power a couple of years ago. And so the police and then the security forces, in other words, the police is actually a large and complicated group in and of themselves, but they don't seem to be up for the task of crowd control or violence mitigation. And then the military, you know, still managed to maintain a fairly popular image among the Egyptian public as the kind of neutral arbiters of state power. And so they have at least the potential to intervene. I mean, they also have the potential at least to kind of try to separate warring factions or nearly warring factions like the Brotherhood. And then, you know, a few of the protesters are also, you know, are armed and come looking for a fight. I mean, that's certainly not true in the majority, but there is an element there. So the military could, you know, either try to do things like surround squares to prevent violence from breaking out, or they could stage, you know, an outright coup. But as you say, I think they're being rather coy, and it's particularly difficult to read their intentions from their public statements, which in any case are rather limited.
So, Sheila Karapiko, what then is the role of the Salafists, who came in second in the Egyptian parliamentary elections that caught everybody by surprise, second to the Brotherhood? And most analysts suggest that they're disproportionately fueled by Saudi and Qatari money that gave them this political win out of nowhere. What role are they taking in all of this?
Well, the Salafis, I mean, they did seem to come out of nowhere in the sense that most Egyptians or Egyptian watchers prior to the uprising against Mubarak, or for the past 20 years, kind of grouped them under the Brotherhood or under the Islamist banner, while at the same time Saudi money, in particular, I think much more than Qatari, has been known, from Indonesia through Nigeria, has funded Salafi mosques and schools and teachings and preachings. And so, clearly Salafists had existed within the Egyptian Islamist movement for a long time. But most people were surprised that they managed to form a party and then to win significant numbers of votes so quickly. Whereas the Brotherhood, of course, is, very long-standing, established opposition party in Egypt, a known entity in some ways. But the Salafists, who are very fundamentalist, they're the real die-hard fanatics, who are almost certainly in the vanguard of attacks on Christians and recently on Shia.
They murdered those four Shia, right?
They murdered those four Shia. Right. And they're extremely sectarian in that way. They're very ideologically Sunni, much, much more than the Brotherhood. They've been attacking liquor stores. You can't spot the men quite so easily by what they're wearing, although they're increasingly kind of blatant in wearing things that would identify them as Salafis. But the women, you can more or less see them visually, who they are.
Why do you see them that way? What do they look like?
The women, one of the marks of mostly Salafis would be beyond the full veil, face, everything, wearing gloves. Mm. So, in other words, not an inch of skin showing anywhere. The men tend to wear these kind of culotte things, kind of short pants with then a short white robe over it, and sometimes the characteristic beard without a mustache. So you see the women, that women's garb, much more than you see that men's garb, at least in Cairo. Now, in some places, in some other communities in Egypt, other cities and particularly small towns, I think they're rather more blatant. And, this is a movement which, as we say, has been funded for a very long time by Saudis, and it's not even clear whether it's the Saudi government itself or individuals within the royal family or individual, billionaires or millionaires who have money to give away. And the Salafis, are not supporting the Brotherhood. So that's almost, a 5th column that could go either way. Presumably in a fight with the secularists, they might side with the Brotherhood, but that's not so clear. So they are a force, I think, sowing sectarianism and chaos, and they're one of the dangerous elements that Morsi can't control either.
And in terms of the liberals, the secularists, the ones that brought about the revolution that feel shut out from it, they, of course, many of them boycotted the elections, which, of course, made it almost certain that the Muslim Brotherhood would win. Are they going to get their act together and be more cohesive? And they seem to suffer from the traditional problems of the political left of factionalism.
Well, the boycott of the election, just briefly on that, the last two candidates were Morsi and, and a holdover from the security forces, Shafiq. And so for many, liberals, progressives, intellectuals, secularists, that wasn't a viable choice at all. And so not voting, did make sense in a certain way. It was an extremely difficult vote for any progressive intellectual or members of the labor union movement to make that choice, because it was really between two forms of reactionism, two extreme right-wing candidates. Now, I do think that of course, you're correct that they're divided or amongst themselves and sometimes even within themselves. So there are those who, this movement to get 15 million signatures to say that Morsi needs to resign and there should be new elections. And, you know, in other words, go back to the streets and force another regime change. And then there are others who, you know, take a kind of little bit more, I don't know, perhaps one might say almost armchair view of the thing, which is, okay, but there is an electoral process and, you know, now we need to work on getting parliament reelected and working on the constitution and so forth. So there's considerable disarray in the movement that brought down Mubarak to begin with.
So what's then, if you have this situation that we're not entirely sure of how it's going to be resolved, and it's very much in flux, and you've got the military sort of waiting in the wings, calling for restraint. I mean, the defense minister is a general, is he not?
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense? And clearly, one of the things that you find throughout the Arab world and in Iran in particular are these the Iranians have a word in Farsi, the hidden hand. There's so many conspiracy theories throughout the Middle East about who's behind the Syrian war, who's behind the troubles in Egypt, and invariably it's the U.S. But my understanding is the U.S. doesn't know what the hell to do here. I mean, do they? What's your sense of what the embassy in Cairo is trying to do, and what Secretary of State Kerry is trying to do?
Well, I mean, the rumor in Egypt is, I mean, completely that the U.S. is backing Morsi and the Brotherhood. And it's, I mean, going around in Cairo, I mean, just everyone asks you, why is Obama supporting Morsi? Why is the U.S. supporting the Brotherhood? It's an extremely difficult conversation to have because, I mean, it's not plausible to me. But most people are so convinced that it's self-evident that it's beyond discussion. I mean, my hunch, if I had to go either way, and it really is a hunch more than, you know, something that I would be able to demonstrate with footnotes or something, is that, you know, the U.S. is closer to the Egyptian military than it is to any other faction or element. I mean, we have very strong, longstanding training and arming and consultation with the military. And so it may be that the, you know, I would assume that there are conversations ongoing between either the State Department or the Defense Department or other elements of the U.S. and the high-ranking officers with whom we have very long-standing and presumably fairly close and cooperative relations. The American ambassador has become a distinctly unpopular figure. She was recently quoted saying that the protesters should show restraint, which was taken as a sign of American support for Morsi and the Brotherhood. So, you know, there is this conspiracy theory, and the conspiracy theory goes so far as to say that the U.S. and the Brotherhood plotted as early as 2008 and 2009 to instigate the uprising against Mubarak and install a Muslim Brotherhood government. So, I mean, that's the perception on the street. I find it unfortunate, but that's what it is.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development and with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo. She's the author of Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. And her forthcoming book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the doubling of student loans, the doubling of interest rates on student loans. My name, and I yearn.
Time.